Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Been great today, isn't it?
I'm here. Welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. How are you doing, ladies and gentlemen, today? This is the first time I've spoken to you, isn't it? No, it isn't. We had an abortive start, ladies and gentlemen, in which my laptop battery died. And now it has miraculously come back to life. I was just getting myself ready to go to PC World to buy a new charger. But for various different reasons, my mother has been staying here. She's gone now. So I was set up on our dining table rather than on my usual desk. And for some reason, I don't know whether it was the plug or the positioning of the cable or what, but it wasn't charging. So let me start all over again, ladies and gentlemen, for today's episode of The Deepest Lore, when I will be doing a structural analysis of the Mr. Men books by Roger Hargreaves. Now we'll come back to that in a second. First thing to mention is that our friend, arguably the premier content creator in the dissident right period, Morgoth's Review, lost his Patreon account today for, quote, medical misinformation. Now, given that Morgoth had never posted anything to his Patreon, that is, that means that he was effectively banned for things that he'd said elsewhere, which is not the first time that Patreon have done this. Apparently, Morgoth still had quite a lot of people on Patreon. So if you would like to support him in his hour of need, I would encourage everybody listening to this who is into Morgoth and who loves him to show your love by subscribing to his Substack or to his Subscribestar or any of the other alternatives. If you still use Patreon, I think I'm still on there, but I moved everybody over to Subscribestar years ago. I would think twice about using Patreon in general, because they're utter scumbags, and whoever did this to Morgoth, instant karma will get them eventually. We have to believe that. Otherwise, the weekend just gone, the US event happened. I know a few guys have actually stayed on an extra night. Apparently it was a great success. There were a lot of really good speeches, apparently. I'm told one of them was so good that Yiz the Eunuch cried during it. People are saying it's some of the best oratory they've ever witnessed. This was Paul Fahrenheit. A guy called Ortho Bro gave a very good speech, I'm told. I gave a remote speech, which was a little bit unusual. I couldn't hear anybody's jokes or anything, so it was kind of difficult to get a feel for what was happening in the room. And like from my end, I was telling these jokes and they were just all falling flat, so it's a little bit strange giving a talk remotely like that. But so I've had pretty good feedback from my talk. I've stuck that talk up on my Substack, which I also encourage people to subscribe to if they have not already. Buy my courses, buy a mug, join the channel. But most importantly of all, we're here for The Deepest Lore. And what are we gathered to talk about here today? So, yes, so we are, Mr. Men was a series of children's books launched in the 1970s by an advertiser called, he was working as a draftsman in advertising. His name was Roger Hargreaves. And apparently one day his son asked him, Dad, how do you draw a tickle? And he drew Mr. Tickle. And the result was the book Mr. Tickle, which then launched, this whole series of books called The Mr. Man. Each Mr. Man has a trait that defines their entire personality, and as we'll talk about, that trait comes to like define their story, and sometimes they reform their trait and sometimes they do not. Now, I will for those people, so in the abortive stream that we did, we established that a number of disgusting sprogs and Americans and so on didn't know or don't know what the Mr. Men are. They're books designed for two to five-year-olds. Every night I read a Mr. Man story to AAA just before she goes to bed. And she's got very good, actually, at naming them. Like after I finish the story, we turn it around and we go through each of them. And, you know, I see how many she can name, you know, Mr. Tickle, Mr. Happy, Mr. Greedy, etc. So she's getting quite good now, at, you know, talking. Yeah, Foundations of Politics. I was meant to record it this past week, but then I had my mother at the lodge, and then I was stuck back here, and there was a storm. It's been there's been all sorts of things preventing me from actually recording it. I need 10 hours basically for everybody fucking leave me alone, so I can I can record it. It will be out. It will be out by the end of this month, without doubt. Without doubt, it will be out in February. I can, yes. Okay, now, for those people who are not familiar with the Mr. Men, I'm going to, there was a cartoon made in the 1970s, narrated by Arthur Lowe of Dad's Army fame. And it was a very lovely TV series as well. I've actually done like a cozy watch through of these once upon a time. If you go in the back annals of the Deepest Lore, on the Deepest Lore playlist, you'll find old Mr. Men streams that I've done. But we're going to watch Mr. Mean. Now, we watched most of this episode before, like in the abortive stream, but I asked the audience, do you want to watch Mr. Mean again, or do you want to watch a different one? And they so love Mr. Mean that 65% of the audience basically want to watch Mr. Mean again. So we're going to watch Mr. Mean again, and I will I'll intersperse it with some commentary as we go. This will get you a feel for what Mr. Men is like, and then I'm going to subject this whole series to structural analysis to give you an idea, ladies and gentlemen, of what we have in store. Here's a bit of my structural analysis. Here's what I've been up to. I stayed up till 4 a.m. doing that. Some of us are that cool, you know. So, but we'll get to that in a moment. So, let us start then with Mr. Mean.
Mr. Mean lived up to his name. He lived in what could have been a nice house, but wasn't. He never painted it, or mended the windows, or repaired the roof. Inside...
I imagine that this is what Lumberg's house looks like. Lumberg, right, let me just tell you, is like a finance guy on, like, you know, six figures. In 5 years of watching this channel, he sent me one $2 super chat, and he got that $2 super chat tax rebated. So he got the VAT back on it, and he charged it to expenses. I imagine this is what his house looks like, but let's carry on.
It was the same. No carpets, no curtains, no pictures, no fires. And Mr. Mean was so mean, he made his furniture out of old Oregon.
Yeah, I can see Zerius is in the chat. If you do a synthwave or dark synth remix of the Mr. Men theme tune, I would love you forever. I would actually love you forever.
Boxes, and then complained about the price of nails. Why, he was so mean. Do you know what he gave his brother for Christmas last year? A piece of coal. It wasn't as if Mr. Mean didn't have any money. Oh, no. He had lots of money. But would he spend it? Not old Meany. Not if he could help it. One day he was sitting in his gloomy kitchen, having a gloomy meal, when there was a knock at the door. Drat, he said, because he didn't like people. Drat and bother. He opened the door, and there on his doorstep stood a wizard. A rather fat wizard.
Hello, said the wizard. I wonder if, by any chance, as it's such a warm day, you could possibly, if it's not too much trouble, be so kind as to, if it's not inconvenient, perhaps, as I'm very thirsty, provide me with, do you think, a glass, if it's not too much to ask, of water, please.
He was a very wordy wizard. No, replied Mr. Mean rudely, and shut the door in his face. How did you get in?
Well, replied the wizard, it was by, how shall I put it, I just, well, you know, wave the old what's-his-name magic wand, don't you know, and then, you know, well, here I am, if you know what I mean. You must be very poor,
he remarked kindly, looking round. Oh, yes, I am, lied Mr. Mean.
Then perhaps I can help you,
said the wizard, pulling up a box to sit down on.
This wizard is when... Is literally content creators coming around Lumberg's house, you know, as Lumberg tries to cover up his millions.
The box didn't move, so the wizard pulled it harder. And this time it did move. In fact, it tipped up and spilled Mr. Mean's money all over the floor.
Well, 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 well. Well, 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 well. It would appear to me that you, sir, are an old meanie.
Mr. Meany didn't hear him. He was too busy scrabbling all over the floor trying to pick up his money.
And meanies need to be taught.
I'll just say that Mr. Meany is doing great things for the economy, creating a deflationary atmosphere, keeping prices down in that local area.
Listen.
And so saying, he waved his magic wand. All the money turned into potatoes. Potatoes.
Oh, dear. Oh dear me. Oh, dear me. Please turn my money back into money. Oh, please, please, please.
Perhaps, replied the wizard.
The wizard has just dropped the price of potatoes but increased the price of money. The exchange ratio between potatoes and money has now been altered. So this wizard is creating havoc in the local economy here with his shenanigans.
But on the other hand, taking all these into account, by and large, things being what they are on the face of it, perhaps not. However,
continued the wordy wizard,
if you make me a solemn promise never to be mean again, then I'll turn the potatoes back into money. But,
he added sternly,
if you are ever mean again, then it's, how shall I put it, then it's potatoes for you, my lad, if not other vegetables as well.
The following day, Mr. Mean decided to walk to town. He never took the bus, because that cost money. On the way, he met an old washerwoman carrying an enormous bundle of washing.
Oh, please, please, kind sir, he said. Could you possibly help me to carry this washing? It's so heavy.
No, replied Mr. Mean. It's your washing. You carry it. But as soon as he'd said...
This is a parable of what people have become like in the atomized society. You know, Mr. Mean should have helped. Where's his Christian spirit, you know?
Then he felt a tingling in his nose. Mr. Mean's nose turned into a carrot.
Oh, no,
he gasped. The old washerwoman chuckled. And then Mr. Mean remembered the wizard's words.
Yes, oh, yes, he cried in a panic. Of course I'll help you, of course.
And the carrot turned back into a nose.
Well, it was out of self-interest and incentives, to be fair. I mean, the wizard has not really taught him to be kind. He's just kind of punishing him, so, you know.
And off he went. The old washerwoman chuckled again and turned back to the wizard. It had been him all along, you see. Then Mr. Mean passed by a cottage garden. In the garden, there was an old man chopping wood.
Excuse me, he called. Could you give an old man a bit of hand, young fellow, my lad?
No, replied Mr. Mean. It's your wood. You chop it. But as soon as the words had passed his lips, guess what happened? His ears turned into tomatoes.
Oh, no,
he gasped. The old man chuckled. Mr. Mean remembered the wizard's words.
Oh, yes, yes, he cried. Yes, of course I'll give you a hand, of course. Mm-hmm.
The old man does look a lot like Afghana, it's true.
And he chopped and chopped until all the wood was cut. And the tomatoes turned back into ears, and off he went. Eventually, Mr. Mean arrived in the town. There was a little boy crying because his ball had got stuck on the top of the wall.
Oh, please, sir, could it... Make my ball down for me.
No, retorted Mr. Mean. Your ball, you... And he stopped. There was a funny tingling feeling in his feet.
Yes, he said hurriedly. Yes, of course I will, of course. Mm.
And he reached up and passed the ball to the boy and went on his way, looking anxiously at his feet. The little boy stopped crying and turned into the wizard.
I think... he said to himself. I think that Mr. Mean, by and large, is beginning, if I'm not very much mistaken, to be not quite so mean. And I think, although I could be wrong, although I never am, that he has, thank goodness, learned his lesson.
And do you know something? Mr. Mean had learned his lesson. Today, he's nothing like so mean as he used to be. And he doesn't keep his money in a box in the kitchen anymore. Today, his house is mended and painted and spick and span. And he's turned into quite a generous sort of fellow. Goodness, he's so generous. Do you know what he gave his brother last Christmas? 2 pieces of coal.
Okay, so that was a demonstration of what the Mr. Men is, what the Mr. Men is like. So we're all on the same kind of page here. I want to introduce you now to some tools of structural analysis that I have used. So as you can see, I have mapped all of the Mr. Men, all 48 of the Mr. Men books. Roger Hargreaves died in 1988. His son, Adam, took over from that point. I think a team of writers, he'd like left some sketches or something. And a team of writers came in from Mr. Slow was the last one that Roger Hargreaves did. And then after Mr. Slow, there was Mr. Brave, Mr. Grumble, Mr. Perfect, Mr. Cheerful. They were all like done by a team of writers using kind of concept notes that Roger Hargreaves had left. And then Adam himself took over and invented Mr. Cool, Mr. Rude, and Mr. Good. Now, originally, I thought that I will only include the Roger Hargreaves originals in the data set, as it were. But I've actually done all 48 of the ones in the collection in the box set that I've got here. Okay. So, with that said, I'm going to. Sorry. Excuse me. I'm going to introduce you to a little bit of Russian formalism and structural analysis. In 1928, Vladimir Prop wrote a book, a study called Mythology of the Folktale, where he went through all of the different Russian folktales, and he wanted to try to uncover what he called deep structure in the folktales. And he basically worked out that there are only like a few different types of stories. And he worked out various categories like the hero and the donor and so on and so forth. And all that's very interesting. But in terms of my methodology, it only forms a backdrop. I have actually, Prop and the Russian formalists, there was a guy called Todorov, and there were some Roman Jakobson and various other kind of... like in communist Russia, they weren't really allowed to talk about anything. So they did all of this weird sort of stuff instead. All of this kind of formalism. And in France, this debonair looking chap here, Roland Barthes, who among other things is notable for having been killed by being run over by a milk float which is something that I've never quite understood, given how slow milk floats are. Do you remember that scene in Austin Powers where the guy gets run over by the steamroller? Like, I just, like, did Roland Barthes just, like, freeze as the milk float kind of? But anyway, he wrote an essay in 1966 called An Introduction to the Structural Analysis of Narrative. And in that, he kind of adapted the work of Propp and others to come up with this terminology, this kind of set of tools in which to approach narratives. Okay, and he said that there were basically these four different units that you can use to break down any narrative. And he uses the example of, as far as I can remember, he uses the example of James Bond, who's about to make a call back to MI6. And so in this little story of James Bond making the call, the important element, the important feature is that he's making the call on the phone, okay? And so that important action that Bond is taking is what Bart calls a cardinal function. A cardinal function is the nucleus of the story. It is the element that if you remove the cardinal function, the actual story collapses. You cannot have the story without the cardinal function occurring. Okay. I mean, you can pick basically any story you care to name. If you sat down and you're really like, well, if that didn't happen, then the whole story wouldn't make any sense. That's the cardinal function. Okay. I'm trying to think of a decent example for you. Let's see. You know, it's just any element, basically any element where it's absolute. Say in the Star Wars narrative, when Luke Skywalker throws Palpatine down the shaft at the end of Return of the Jedi, that's a cardinal function in the story of the Star Wars saga, right? It's without that happening, other elements of Return of the Jedi don't work anymore. Okay. So it's a cardinal function. A catalyst is are kind of smaller actions that lead up to, that kind of help to support the cardinal function, but that aren't that important. For example, in this story where James Bond is making the phone call, I mean, let's imagine that Ian Fleming wrote, Bond picked up the receiver. He made the call to Q or whatever it was. Okay. The cardinal function is the fact that he's making this call. The catalyst is him just picking up. This is an incidental bit of action. Well, you could say, well, you know, he can't make the call if he doesn't pick up the receiver. But Bart says, well, realistically, that's just an incidental detail. So that's a catalyst. Okay. I mean, what's a catalyst? If you've ever seen the Peter Jackson Hobbit movies, you know, the fucking half hour where the dwarves are, you know, singing and dancing and like eating all of Bilbo Baggins's food, like all of those things happen. But if you took that away, the story would still make sense. So all of those actions that occur there are catalysts, not cardinal functions. Does that make sense? A catalyst is incidental action. A cardinal function is vital action without which the narrative will collapse. And then we have indices and informants. Now, an indice or an index, it's a single index, is some extra information. So some adjectival information about the character or the situation that informs the entire narrative. So the fact that James Bond is 007, a special agent who works for Her Majesty's government and is on the side of law and order. Sorry. The fact that James Bond is this special agent informs everything else about the story, once you know this about James Bond, okay? This means it is an indice. It's a vital piece of information that you cannot really do without. It's information that is intrinsic to making sense of the narrative. Whereas an informant is a piece of incidental information that's not that. You know, James Bond, 007, working for Her Majesty, picked up the telephone receiver. He was wearing a red jumper. The red jumper is just an incident, like it's just an informant. Whereas the fact that he's 007 is an index. Okay. So or if you want to go back to those dwarves in The Hobbit, you know, the important information is that the one dude is the king, right? Or is the heir to the throne or whatever. That's the important bit of information. And that he's made an alliance with Bilbo. The informant, the kind of non-essential information is that one of them happens to be fat and likes cheese. You know, this is just like, all right, okay, it's nice to know, but it's not really doing much else for the narrative. So this is the way that Roland Barthes, and he actually applied this to some pretty difficult texts, like he applied it to Balzac, and, you know, he wanted to use this as a way of, like, reading text in a different way, in this kind of, like, people are saying it's autistic, but this is like reading text in a structural way to see through all of the extraneous, like what actually matters here, what matters to the narrative, what is extraneous. And so this is a way of describing texts using structural analysis, as opposed to other forms, more ideologically driven forms like psychoanalysis or, I don't know, Marxism or something like that. This is just pure structuralism now, okay? Now, using Roland Barthes, I approached all 48 of the texts of the Mr. Men, and I worked out that basically most stories, they start, you know, you get a description of the Mr. Man's house. Sometimes you get a location. Then they have a series of encounters. And I've noted down who they encounter each time. Then I've talked about the general form of the story. And I'll explain all of this soon. And then if there is a reformer, who is the person responsible for the Reformation? Okay, I mean, so Mr. Mean, which we just watched, he had a never painted house. We don't know where that was. He encounters a wizard, an old washerwoman, the old man chopping wood, the little boy crying. He is reformed at the end, although there is that little joke about the two lumps of coal. But ultimately, Mr. Mean is reformed, and it was the wizard who did the reforming. Okay, so you can see this spreadsheet is basically stripping out the vital information of each story, okay, and leaving aside some of those other incidental details, like the fact that the wizard was fat or the fact that the wizard was waffly and so on. None of that stuff really matters. That's just like flavor, you know. And so if you have a look using this methodology, I have discerned the basic structure of Mr. Men's stories is as follows, okay? There is the establishment of the Mr. Man's house. And this is, I mean, it's an informant veering on an index. It's kind of, this is some very important establishing atmosphere. It gives you a sense of what the Mr. Man is like, but it is kind of incidental. Like some of the Mr. Men live in like nice little cottages and things, and it doesn't really give you that much of an insight into their character, but it gets you into the mindset of thinking about, like, usually the house reflects the personality. Then there is usually a sequence where there is the demonstration of the trait. Now, almost always in the Mr. Men stories, this involves the Mr. Man having breakfast. They sit down at their breakfast. They sit down at the dining table and they'll have like boiled eggs and toast, or they'll have like a full English or something. And the trait, whatever it is, will come to show itself. So, for example, Mr. Strong has tons of eggs with his breakfast. Mr. Greedy has, you know, 20 sausages. Mr. Tickle uses his long arms to make the toast. Mr. Topsy Turvy gets everything upside down. Mr. Wrong, I think, ends up like, you know, putting jam on his tea and putting tea on his toasts and things like that. So there's a demonstration of traits, a demonstration of the trait. And this is an index because this trait, which is going to be firmly established in your mind at the start, is going to inform the entire rest of the narrative. And bearing in mind these are narratives for 2 and 3 and 4 year olds, this is a very simple little narrative, these little books. But I'm using this to try to give you a set of tools by which to approach kind of more complex narratives as well. And hopefully you'll see like the utility of doing this once we've come through. I also want to do this to show how, in a way, elements of these Mr. Men books at a structural level have an element of subversion to them that most people would never even notice. Now, you may read one of these books and think, there's something a little bit unusual about that. But you wouldn't be able to put your finger on why. But this structural analysis I'm about to give you will give you the tools to understand why some of these Mr. Men books feel a little bit off once you finish with them. As wholesome and as great as they seem, there's something at a structural level, whether Roger Hargreaves knew what he was doing or whether he did not know what he was doing, that I will unveil through my structural analysis. So I hope people are ready. People are still watching. Let us continue. So there's the demonstration of the trait. There is the encounters, which will test the trait. These encounters form a cardinal function. As you saw in the Mr. Mean there, his encounter with the wizard was a cardinal function. Okay. And then Mr. Man is either reformed or he is not. And this is another cardinal function. Mr. Mean's house was fixed. This is a cardinal function. It shows that his character, his trait has been cured, as it were. Okay. Now, there are 5 variants of this structure that using these tools I have identified. Okay. Not all Mr. Men stories are created equally. Not all Mr. Men stories follow the same narrative. There is the first variant of the structure, as we saw with Mr. Mean there, is the one where they go through this series of encounters, and at the end, their end of it, the Mr. Man comes out reformed. He drops his trait in some way. He is cured. There is a buildings Roman narrative at the heart of it. He has learned something. He has gone on a journey, and he's learned. Okay? Now, this is very interesting. This learning something is quite a modern narrative. It's a narrative that did not exist in ancient Greek literature, for example, where they were much more interested in archetypes. Okay, this is a much more recent phenomena. The idea that the hero is going to learn, and he's going to come out the other end of the text transformed in some way. He has changed. There's actually an ideology behind it. It's the ideology of liberalism, of bourgeois self-improvement, or it's the idea that you can overcome hardwired traits in yourself through virtuous habits. I mean, I guess you could argue there's a bit of this in like Aristotle and things like that, maybe. But if you have a look at Aristotle's Poetics, the Poetics do not. Aristotle's idea of what literature was doing was not going on this character arc where the character learned something. Okay. Usually in Greek literature, they had archetypes where fundamental forces collide and one of them comes out on top. Okay. I think this is a very interesting thing to consider. But anyway, so one of the structures is what is this structure where the Mr. Man is reformed at the end of it, and they've gone on a journey and they've learned. If I was to pinpoint the form that popularized the idea of the individual journey, it would be the novel. The novels of the 18th century and the 19th century often had this kind of learning, this internal reform that goes on. Okay. And this is like, when we're talking about deep structure in this way, I think most people are not used to, it seems like, oh, well, so what? This is very surface level analysis, you know, why do we care about these sorts of things? But when we uncover the deep structure, you uncover something about the mindset of the culture, okay? And if you think about this fundamental narrative of reform, of the character who fixes something, well, I mean, basically all romantic comedies have this structure. You know, think of Groundhog Day or any Bill Murray movie. Every Bill Murray movie is Mr. Mean. At the end of the day, he's uptight, you know, Scrooged or Groundhog Day, or even like name some other Bill Murray movies. It's all about the character going on a journey, learning something about themselves, and fixing that one thing about themselves. Okay, so I'm not saying it's woke. I did not say it's woke. Wokies are. I hope people understand. Wokesters are just fucking idiots, okay? They're just like, they're not part of these conversations we're having are much deeper conversations, which they are not a part of. They just destroy everything else, you know, they're not really part of these sorts of things. Although I will say that this method of deconstruction did prefigure the Wokies. In many ways, like most of the Wokies will learn some Roland Barthes at some point, but they tend to forget all of this stuff that I'm telling you now. So anyway, yes, the idea of reform, I think, is a very, you know, in Oswald Spengler's terms, it's kind of a Faustian idea. You know, it's about man overcoming himself in a way. But then we have the much more old-fashioned unreformed structure, where basically we're introduced to this archetypal character who has this single trait, but then over the course of the story, they don't learn anything. They just like, this is Mr. Tickle. He's a guy who loves tickling people. He tickles loads of people in the village. He goes back home and laughs to himself. The end. He's unreformed. He like nothing changes. And plenty of the characters, and I've done a frequency analysis of this as well. I would say just about a third, maybe almost a half of all of the Mr. Men tales basically have the character unreformed at the end. Now, in some cases, you could say, well, the trait is not, but like Mr. Strong, for example, you know, well, it's not that bad a thing to be strong, even though it's a bit of a pain for him because he keeps on like breaking his front door and so on. He just finds a way to utilize his strength, like, you know, for the common good. But he doesn't reform himself. He doesn't lose the trait. You know, Mr. Happy, for example, begins the tale as Mr. Happy and ends, but you can say, well, it's quite a good thing to be happy. So a lot of the, you know, if they already have heroic traits, you don't want them to lose it. In a way. So there is it does make a difference if you've got a positive or a negative trait, but sometimes even the ones with negative traits come out unreformed, as we'll talk about. And I find that, I find the idea of the narrative where nobody changes also very interesting. I find it interesting because Hollywood, through all of these comedy movies and dramas and things that we watched, has taught us and trained us to look for the character transformation. Whereas in most literature and history, And Lord of the Rings is a very good example of this. The characters do not reform. Aragorn was the hero, you know, he starts a hero and he ends a hero. He doesn't, like, you know, have some like crisis of confidence, you know, go on a journey of self-discovery and then embrace his role of the true king and all of this. He knows it from the start. Aslan knows it from the start in Narnia. You know, it's like Samwise is loyal to Frodo from the start, because Lord of the Rings and Tolkien was dealing with archetypes. He was not dealing with the modern invention of the character who goes on a psychological journey and learns something about themselves. So I think it's just worth thinking about that a little bit and looking out for it, because I think when it comes to the archetypal narratives rather than the buildings roman, which we're also used to, I think it resonates with people when they see archetypal characters, but they don't have a language or they don't have a set of tools by which to understand why that is. You know, and it's a very interesting thing. I mean, I'm starting with the Mr. Men here because it's nice and simple. But if people enjoy this, I may start to think about some more complex texts as we go forward. But the idea of the unreformed character, very interesting. Okay. Now, then we have the opposite doppelganger. This is where a character comes across somebody who is their opposite in some way, and through the encounter with their mirror opposite, you know, maybe they'll learn something about themselves and be reformed, or maybe they will not. Sometimes the encounter with the opposite doppelganger kind of confirms them in their trait. Okay. Fourth, they are saved from an ordeal of some kind. Their trait, like, for example, Mr. Quiet here, he lives in a place called Loudland, and everybody's loud, and he wants quiet, and basically, like, he escapes, and Mr. Happy helps him get away, and he ends up getting a job in a library. So he's basically, like, he's not reformed, he's saved from a situation where his trait was causing an issue for him. And then finally, there's this type of story where there's just an adventure. You know, there's no real character arc. It's just a series of, like, vignettes of doing exciting stuff. So I broke down each of these in terms of what the narrative looks like. So as we saw with Mr. Mean just now, there's the establishment of the house, the informant, the demonstration of the trait, the index, the encounter in which characters seek to teach Mr. Man a lesson, the cardinal function, and you saw the wizard immediately wanted to teach Mr. Mean a lesson after he'd seen how mean he was. And then finally, the Mr. Man is reformed, and we saw that Mr. Mean had spent the money to fix his house, even though he still gave his brother two lumps of coal. So that's the reform narrative. Then there's the unreformed narrative, where, I mean, Mr. Tickle is the greatest example, because he doesn't learn anything. He just loves tickling people. He goes around tickling people and then laughs to himself that he's tickled a load of people. Tickles a teacher, tickles, like, he just causes mayhem and then chuckles to himself. Now, this is a very interesting story, the unreformed Mr. Man tale, because if you break it down using a Roland Barthes functions, there's you get the informant, the house, demonstration of the trait, well, that's an index. Encounters in which the trait is further demonstrated, that's an index. Mr. Man is unreformed, index. Well, that's very interesting, because now we have an entire narrative that happens without any cardinal functions whatsoever. So in a strange way, there's something, there's a lot of these tales where you'll reach the end of it and you'll be like, something was weird about that. What was weird about it? And in the case of Mr. Tickle and many of these other stories, the thing that's weird about it is that it's not a story. there's no actual story to Mr. Like, Mr. Tickle is a man who likes tickling people. He goes around tickling people, and that's it. Well, that's not a story. That's a description of a man. So, this fact that there are no functions whatsoever, if you use Bart's terminology, that means there isn't a plot. And several of these tales have no plot, effectively. And I find that very interesting. I find that it's like, did Roger Hargreaves know he was doing what post-structuralists might call, like, he was breaking grand meta-narratives by having these subversive stories like Mr. Tickle that don't actually have any plot? Because I mean, people think in terms of narrative and they think in terms of plot points. But a story like Mr. Tickle has no plot points. And I find that the subversive potential in having narratives without narrative very interesting. I've always found it very interesting. I tried to write a dystopian fiction without any narrative, if you remember. Those of you who bought my complete works of Maxwell House will have found, the dystopian fiction is basically just a description of a dystopian world without any characters, without any emotional ways in, without any plot points, without any resistance tales, with nothing, just a description. And there's something about that I think is confrontational to the way that the human mind works. So, yes, that is kind of interesting. And there's more than one. It's not just Mr. Tickle. More than one of the Mr. Men tales are all indexed. They have no story. Then you have the opposite doppelganger. Like, there's Mr. Fussy. Mr. Clumsy turns up. Mr. Fussy's so fussy, he polishes his flowers individually. Each petal of the flowers he polishes. Mr. Clumsy turns up and he steps on all of the petals. And as you can imagine, he causes mayhem in Mr. Fussy's house. Here we get, you know, the usual establishing shot of the house. Demonstration of the trait. Yeah, he's a very fussy guy. Then the opposite doppelganger turns up. In this case, it's Mr. Clumsy. And the Mr. Man is reformed or not. That's the cardinal function. And basically what happens at the end of Mr. Fussy is that Mr. Fussy is just, like, relieved that Mr. Clumsy's going away again. So he doesn't, like, stop being fussy or anything. And in fact, in many cases, there is no reformation at the end of the opposite doppelganger. It's just it just confirms both of the Mr. Men in their traits. Like, for example, in Mr. Busy's story, Mr. Busy loves, like, rushing around and doing all sorts of things, and he can never sit still. But his next door neighbor is Mr. Slow, and he's like, he tries to make Mr. Slow go mountain climbing, and he tries to make him go walking, and he tries to make him go on holidays. And basically, at the end of the story, Mr. Slow is just, like, happy to be shot of Mr. Busy. Oh dear, I've got my battery problem again. Oh shit, says I've only got 6 minutes left. Let me get this to work again. Hold on. Then we get the save from the ordeal. I mentioned Mr. Quiet. We get the usual first two pieces of the story, but then the Mr. Man lives in a place that makes his trait uniquely troublesome. The Mr. Man is saved by someone who intervenes. In the case of Mr. Quiet, it's Mr. Happy, of course. In fact, as we'll see, it's often Mr. Happy. I don't know why, but Mr. Happy seems to crop up quite a lot to save either Mr. Men from ordeals. Like, he becomes like the kind of Mario or Ryu character. He's always cropping up. And then we also get the adventure where there's this little boy like Jack, I think this one's name is, and an exciting Mr. Man like Mr. Impossible. Mr. Cool is like this. Mr. Daydream is like this, where basically there's a little dweeb, little schoolboy. Mr. Man turns up. They go on a series of adventures. Mr. Man buggers off again, and the schoolboy goes home happy. Nobody quite believes what he's lived through. And for some reason, every once in a while, they run this alternative narrative where it's more about the little schoolboy having fun than it is about the Mr. Man. And in those stories, the Mr. Man has no house. He just kind of
turns up one day like Mary Poppins, okay? I'm having battery trouble again, folks. Oh, shit. Make sure this battery works. Come on, battery. It does seem to be on its last legs here, this battery. Okay, I've got it back. I've got it back. Oh, shit. Come on. I think the connection has gone loose, like down at the bit where it plugs in, you know. Come on. All right. If I disappear, it's because this battery is going to go again. So anyway, I did a frequency analysis of all of the different forms of these stories. And as you can see, the majority of them actually have unreformed as the main form. 16 have the reformed narrative, 6 with the opposite doppelganger, 5 have the adventure structure, and just 3 have the save from the ordeal. In terms of guest appearances, Mr. Happy turns up in 8 of the books, Mr. Greedy in 7. The Wizard turns up in 6 of them. Although, interestingly, the Wizard doesn't always look the same. Although I've had a look at the lore on the Mr. Men, and even though he looks different in several different tales, he's always the same Wizard. The Wizard that we saw in Mr. Mean there is the same Wizard who we see in Mr. Sneeze, even though the Wizard in Mr. Sneeze is skinny with a beard. Okay. Oh, shit, this battery. Come on. Okay. I may just have to leave it here. We'll just have a short stream. Walter the Worm makes 9 appearances, folks. And the farm. And then there are lots of different, occupations. Farmers crop up 7 times. Postman has 5 appearances. The Butcher turns up 4 times. And they've all got names like kind of Mr. Meat the Butcher or, you know, Mrs. Crumbs the Baker's Wife and things like that. And one of the things I love about these tales is the frequency by which these sorts of characters turn up. They're kind of lovely kind of English villages. 3 doctors, 2 bakers, 2 policemen, 2 kings, and 2 teachers. So this is the kind of the world that populates. And in some of the stories, as I'll pull up on my spreadsheet here, on some of the stories, all of the villagers get together. So for example, in Mr. Nosey's story, Mr. Chips, Mrs. Washer, Mr. Brush, and Mr. Heard the Farmer all get together to teach Mr. Nosey a lesson to stop being so nosy. They put like a peg on his nose and all sorts of things. So sometimes the villagers gang up and, they're sick of the trait. That also happens, for example, in Mr. Noisy, where the villagers, it's basically like a village. If you think about it, it's vigilante justice. It's the villagers getting together and they're like, right, we're going to lynch you, basically. So that's kind of interesting as well. All right. I might as well have a look at some super chats, and then I will just read out some questions until my battery dies, basically. And then I'm going to have to go to PC World later and replace this because it's really not working. I've got about 10 minutes left here, so I will just take questions. In the super chats, Here's the Eunuch says, you giving your speech remotely on screen made you seem even more like Palpatine. We all had a big laugh about it. Your jokes all landed well, and we all thought your points were salient. Well done. Well, thank you very much, Yiz. One of the jokes I made was, I mentioned if demographic replacement was going to be slowed down, it would require mass deportations. And then I said, and not just the men, but the women. and the children. But again, because I couldn't hear anyone, I was like, nobody's laughing at my jokes. What's going on? So anyway, that was that. Yiz says, epic AA voice clip. Little AAA is already getting good at naming them. Yiz the Eunuch says, the wizard looks and sounds like Ruba. That's a good point. He did actually look a bit like Ruba, that wizard. And Time Stealer says, Mr. Mean has that Sigma grind set. The wizard is a fat midwit trans civil servant who worships the gay and looks like Ruba. So there we go. The wizard lost the optics battle. And then I will just have a look at if there's been any other super chats, and then I will take just general questions from the normal chat while my battery slowly dies. So okay, Ben Wheeler says, Roland the Rat has been my favorite name so far because I had a stuffed rat named Roland. I just wanted to get that off my chest. Well, thank you very much, Ben Wheeler. It means so much. Joseph Langmead says, the eternal subversive Mr. Nosy. Can we get an ethnicity check? Well, he's a very nosy character. Anybody else got any Thundercats deepest lore when? I actually know more about Thundercats than you could possibly imagine, because I had to review the Thundercats box set at one point for this cartoon website, like about 10 years ago. So there's quite a bit of Thundercats deepest lore. They actually had a series bible. Like the Thundercats is one of the better thought through series of that era. It wasn't like He-Man was like a kind of commercial for action figures, and they frequently like introduced characters just to sell like new action figure chains. Whereas Thundercats had a series bible, and it had like dedicated lore and all sorts of things. So Thundercats could be a genuine deepest lore. Yeah. What was the king's name? There are two kings. There's the king of the goblins, who turns up in Mr. Uppity, and then he basically teaches Mr. Uppity to stop being so rude to everybody. And then there's the king of Nonsense Land, who gives Mr. Silly the nonsense cup for painting the leaves of a tree or something, I seem to recall. Okay, what else? King of the Goblins, indeed. Isn't the Epic of Gilgamesh a personal development story? Well, it really depends on... you'd have to look into each case on its own. What it depends on is, does the fundamental core character of the hero change? Or do they start and end the story unaltered? An example of a hero that doesn't change throughout the whole story is Oliver Twist. Oliver Twist is like a little angel at the start, and he's like a little angel at the end. Nothing changes. In the world of Charles Dickens, characters are either good or they're bad. End. He doesn't have development in that way. He does have some characters who learn, like I suppose Pip in Great Expectations, for example, is a bit more complex. But generally in Dickens, they're either good or bad. Whereas in certain other narratives, you can think about, there's a fundamental alteration. The easiest example I can think of is the Bill Murray rom-com, or any romantic comedy, where usually the male protagonist learn something about themselves, stops being such a hard ass or whatever, or grows up, or there's some development there, and they're not the same at the end of the story as they are at the start. Okay. Dickens has a little bit of character development. He has a little bit. I mean, Scrooge is a good example. So yeah, he kind of played it, but Dickens, more than most 19th century novelists, has archetypes in his stories. Very obvious, like, this is a baddie, this is a goodie type situations, you know. Why Mr. Men, and how does this help us in the current year or situation? Well, Last of Us, the deepest law is not always political in nature. We have done shows on the Muppets. We've done shows on all sorts of things on the deepest law. It's a show about culture. It's a show about breaking down culture. It's a show about, sometimes we look at propaganda techniques. So it's a kind of a non-political show in a way. You can use it for tiger riding, but I do think that this set of structural tools I've given you could be used for other purposes, but it would be up to you to figure that out in your own time. All right, what is the best Royal Rumble? Oh, it's Royal Rumble 92, without doubt, the Ric Flair one. You know, Bobby the Brain on commentary, Flair's performance, the whole story from start to finish. It will always be Royal Rumble 92. So yes. Is Canada lost? No, maybe this could be the catalyst for Canada being found again. You know, I hope Trudeau will not survive. Yes. All right. Shall we wrap up here? I think before my battery completely gives up the ghost. Smurf analysis. So the Smurfs is an interesting one. NWA Four Horsemen Deepest Lore sometime. Yeah, I mean, I love the, you know, that 86-87 era of the Four Horsemen is great. Prisoner Cell Block H will be coming at some point. I want to get Lady of Shalott for that. I want to get Lady of Shalott for that. Fink Finger says, hey, will there be any more Christians versus other spirituality streams? The Catholics and Pods are running free lately. I want to get Frody from Guide to Culture on to give that. People from the pagan side have complained that my guests haven't been up to scratch and that I put too many Christians on and they're always outnumbered and I'm always unfair to them. And I think that nobody could argue that Frody is not a serious guy. It's just a case of trying to fix a date with him and do that. So, yes. Public Enemy Deepest Lore. I mean, my favorite bit of Deepest Lore on Public Enemy is that they had that, like, the SW1s, who were just like security and dancing. I loved the fact that there were so many members of Public Enemy who didn't actually rap or produce music. They were just like thugs, basically, who hung around with Chuck D. So, yes. Yeah, the S1Ws, that's it. I don't know if Lumberg heard me calling him out during Mr. Mean earlier on. So, yep. AAI, Iowa Truck, honk. Nathan CJ Hood says, is structuralism a gateway to elite theory? I do think that there's a certain amount of formalism or formalist analysis in elite theory and in Curtis Yarvin as well. So there is some formalism in that because you're understanding deep structure and you're looking beyond all of the things that don't actually matter at the end of the day. Valero 393 says, Attitude Era Deepest Lore, Private Hell WWF versus WWE. I will not do the Attitude Era. It's too mainstream. I don't want to do things that every Tom, Dick and Harry can do. I only want to do things that nobody knows about. Like, I would sooner do a Deepest Lore on Choshu's army and how revolutionary that angle was in New Japan, and then they took it to all Japan in the 80s, than I would ever touch the Attitude Era. I don't like doing things that if the likes of a Razor Fist can speak to it, I don't want to do it. Okay, I would sooner do a Deepest Lore on the career of Bob Backlund than I would on doing something that Razor Fist could talk about. I noticed Razor Fist was having a go at wrestling channels the other day, but the fact of the matter is that if I sat down with Razor Fist, he'd get an education, because he is, as far as I'm concerned, just another generic fan as well. So there we go. All right, everybody, I think that'll do. More Batman. I mean, I don't know what happened to those Batman comic streams. They weren't very popular, though. They weren't very popular. I don't know if it was that because of Mark, or was that because of people aren't into like late 80s Batman comics. You know, why? Yes. So there we are. Remember, pick up Foundations of Politics on pre-order. Pick up Trivium. Pick up subscription to my Substack. Join the channel. Buy a mug. Support Morgoth, because he's just been kicked off Patreon. And I'll see you tomorrow night for Unpopular Opinions. Now get out.